Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Chances are, when I say the name David Hossack, it doesn't ring any bells. But this pioneering doctor and botanist from early American history shaped modern medicine and lived shoulder to shoulder with the founding fathers. Historian and author Victoria Johnson unearthed Hossack's story and wrote about it in her new book, American Eden. I talked with Johnson recently and asked her to explain how Hossack, who was born in 1769 in a very young Manhattan, went from studying medicine to studying botany.
He was by no means the first in the United States. Of course, there was a long history of Native peoples with expansive knowledge about the medicinal powers of plants. Mm-hmm. And then there were botanists such as the Bartram family, pioneers near Philadelphia, pioneer botanists who were experimenting with all kinds of plants, but including medicinal plants. It was a component of medical education in the early American Republic. But in New York, when Hossack was studying medicine, it was not the main emphasis. And it wasn't until he went to Edinburgh, which was where the best medical education in the Western world could be had at the University of Edinburgh medical faculty. It wasn't until he went there that he really grasped how important botany was to medicine, because there were botanical gardens that his medical professors were taking the students to teach them about medicinal plants so that they could see them growing in the gardens rather than just looking at them in textbooks. And that's when Hossack really put it together.
And at that time, botany had just gone through a major change where Linnaeus, is that how you say his name?
Yes, Carl Linnaeus.
Had many followers who were trying to establish a way to have a common language to discuss plants all around the world. How did he, Linnaeus, inspire the generation of Hossack's generation?
So Linnaeus was the man who, more than any other, he was by no means the only botanist working in the 18th century, but he was the man who kind of sliced through a lot of chaos in nomenclature that prevented botanists around the world from sharing their discoveries with one another. So botanists would give new plants or plants they thought were newly discovered these long descriptive Latin names, sometimes in their native languages, not even in Latin. And it was very hard for botanists in different countries to figure out whether they were even talking about the same plants. And Linnaeus came up with a system of known as binomial nomenclature, in which he gave each plant that he knew of and that he could identify and catalog a two-word Latin name, the genus and the species. And that wasn't adopted uniformly everywhere right away. The French held out for a long time, particularly. But it did catch on, and that was the system that Hossack trained in when he got to London, which is where he went after studying medicine in Edinburgh and discovering botany. He moved to London because it was the capital of British botany, and there he studied in the collections of the late Carl Linnaeus at an institution that had been founded expressly to safeguard these collections, and that was called the Linnaean Society of London. So Hossack was trained in Linnaean botany, and when he returned to the United States, he had the most advanced possible knowledge of Linnaean botany, and he was one of the best-trained botanists in the young nation when he returned.
So how did he forge his way following both medicine and botany when he came back to New York?
First, he set up his medical practice, private medical practice, in Lower Manhattan. And then he was very quickly appointed a professor of medicine and botany at Columbia College. He was in his mid-20s. He was an incredibly charismatic and brilliant and self-confident man, bordering on the arrogant at times. But he began to draw hordes of students to his classrooms because he was such a charismatic lecturer. And it was there, in this dual appointment as a professor of medicine and botany, that he began to realize what a disadvantage it was to American medicine that there was no public medical research garden in which he could train young American doctors, the next generation of American doctors, his students. And he began to dream of founding the nation's first public botanical garden.
And you write in the book that his dream has less in common with a beautiful city park than with the National Institutes of Health, the Food and Drug Administration, the Centers for Disease Control, and CRISPR gene editing laboratories, which I just love. So he's trying to establish it at a time, and I want people to get a picture of the city that he's in, because I think it's really hard not to think of New York and think of it being a world-class city, the biggest and most vibrant city in the United States and one of the most vibrant in the world. Yeah, but you did write here, it was a thrilling time to be young in New York. As Hossack traced the circuit between his home and his classes, he might at any given moment cross paths with the most famous men in the country, men who are tussling over the fate of the national experiment. So what was New York like right then? You say it was thrilling, but it was also kind of a backwater, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was one of the things I tried to do in American Eden was just kind of time travel. I would close my eyes and try to imagine, based on maps and contemporary accounts, what it would have been like to walk down the streets of this city when Hussack was a young man in the 1790s. Yes, thrilling because everybody was there or had just been there when he was a teenager. The capital had moved to Philadelphia. But there, it was still a center of American politics, but it was above all a commercial center. It was still a small town, but it was a small town known for its commerce. And Hussack, after studying in Edinburgh and London, realized when he got back to New York that here was a city lacking the great institutions of Europe. Botanical gardens, museums. It had a theater. It had a library. It had some of the institutions we associate with a great city. But it had pigs running through the streets and mud everywhere. And Hussack, as a member of this post-founding, post-revolutionary generation, dreamed of putting his city on the map, culturally and scientifically. Now, the greatest city in the United States at the time was undisputedly Philadelphia, which had many venerable, already old and venerable institutions. And Hussack was a bit competitive with Philadelphia, and he looked around New York City and saw an opportunity to be heroic in an entirely new way. His elders had fought a revolution and framed a new government. And for his generation, some of his peers and friends, the great challenge was to found the civic institutions that would stabilize the young nation and bring it some respect in the eyes of haughty Europe.
You write in the book, I keep quoting your own book back to you. I want people to get a sense of this book, though. So you said that Hussack himself was a new species of American, one who devoted most of his waking hours to inventing and organizing the civic institutions that would guide his city, state, and nation through the fractious post-revolutionary years. While he worked tirelessly on the botanical garden, he was also a member of at least half a dozen other charitable, cultural, and scientific enterprises, and playing a leading role in the education of the country's next generation of doctors. So he had so many interests, and obviously he loved medicine and botany. And then he decided to take on founding this botanical garden. And were there other botanical gardens in the United States at this time? And why did, do you think, I mean, obviously he loved botany, but why did that one feel like the thing that he should be doing for New York and for the United States?
There were other botanical gardens. The most well-known one at the time was the Bartram Family Garden outside Philadelphia. And that was a very important garden, and it's very much worth a visit today. It's in fabulous shape under some wonderful leadership. I really recommend anybody go see this, because Bartram's, John Bartram's house is still there, and it's just charming and beautiful. What Husick had in mind was not a private garden of the sort that the Bartrams were running, but a public institution that was funded by the government and run for the benefit of his fellow citizens very explicitly. And that would be really a research facility. There wasn't anything quite like this in the United States at the time. And the reason Husick thought it was so important was that a private citizen could not create and run an institution on the scale, the educational programs, the collections, the buildings. He needed public money. There weren't great fortunes of the kind that helped found the New York Botanical Garden in the 1890s. Those didn't really exist in the United States yet. And there also wasn't a sense of – there wasn't a strong philanthropic tradition that private citizens would come together, as became very common in the late 19th century and into the Gilded Age. So Husick really needed public support to create an institution that would – become this research institution where he could take medical students and they could conduct pioneering research on medicinal plants. And the story of whether he got that help and how is the story of American Eden.
It was the thing he had in mind. He decided to build it and then hoped. It was a big dream and a long shot for him to get that funding. How were institutions, you said Bartram's Garden was private. How were other places, other institutions trying to get started? What were these other funding mechanisms that were around at that time?
There were really two kinds of philanthropic or charitable organizations, or what we might today call, you know, 501c3s. That's not what they were at the time. There were two models. And one was a subscription society where usually, you know, well-to-do gentlemen would form a society and they would become subscribers to support a new institution. The problem was that usually meant that they were the ones who had the right to, say, view the sculptures and paintings. Mm-hmm. In the case of the first Museum of Fine Arts in New York, sometimes the public could come in for a ticket price. That was one model. The other was the fully charitable institution that sometimes got some state or city funding. And this was something like the almshouse or a charitable hospital. What Husick had in mind was a research institution that was for the benefit of the medical students and by extension for the benefit of, you know, the patients who would presumably be saved by that through that training of the next generation of doctors. But his organization was neither a straight-up charitable institution of the sort of hospital kind, nor was it meant as a subscription society. So he had to invent a new form in a way, and because he fell between two stools. So he lobbied for money from the state, and people couldn't quite understand what he was trying to do and couldn't see the value of it. New York, after all, Manhattan was covered with farms and forests at this time, north mm-hmm. of New York City. And I should say that New York City was in the toe of Manhattan Island at the time. It was around 60,000 people. So people thought it was a kind of crazy idea to put a stone wall around 20 acres of land and start growing plants. Why would you need to do that when Manhattan was covered with farms and the state of New York was covered in forests? So people really didn't understand what he was trying to do.
And one person protested, saying that if it had been nearer the city, that would be one thing. But it was so far outside of New York City that it was not going to be of any benefit. Where did he end up putting his botanical garden that felt to some people so far away from New York City?
He bought 20 acres of land with his own money after he gave up on getting funding, public funding. He bought 20 acres of land 3.5 miles north of New York City. And to get there, he had to go up a country lane called the Middle Road that ran up the spine of Manhattan Island. And to get there, he went through fields and groves and along this dusty country lane. And he came to his parcel of land, which was covered with mountain laurel and viburnum and violets. And the reason he bought it so far, relatively far away from New York City, today it's the heart of Manhattan, but the reason he bought land 3.5 miles north of New York City is that it was a beautiful parcel of land that had a lot of variety of soils on it, so he could grow a lot of different kinds of plants successfully. And it was also for sale, which was important because there was a lot of farmland that in between the city and this parcel that was not for sale. So this is what he came up with. And he decided if he went ahead and built this garden with his own money, he went into terrible debt doing it, but he decided that he would be able to show his fellow citizens what a botanical garden was, since he couldn't just describe it. So like a lot of innovators, he had to do it before he could persuade other people of its value.
So we have an arboretum here in the Twin Cities that, I mean, they do science there. It's mainly trying to find plants that were willing to grow in the zone 3 hardiness zone. what kind of plants, where did he get the plants for his botanical garden, and what kind of science was going on there?
He got his plants from two main kinds of sources. First, he took his students and two of his nephews who came to work with him, and they went traipsing through the fields of Manhattan, New Jersey, and Long Island collecting native species. We have records of some of these plants. They've survived in the spectacular herbarium of the New York Botanical Garden. So we know some of the plants. We know what plants they got at Hoboken, for example, and what's today Jersey City, not places we think of as great botanizing locations. And they collected native plants because one of the main goals of the Elgin Botanic Garden, as Husick named his garden after his father's hometown of Elgin, Scotland, one of his main goals was to identify native species that might have medicinal properties that people didn't know about yet, and thus replace some of the expensive, hard-to-import non-native plants. He wanted a pharmacy of plants growing right on Manhattan Island. So one source was these local plant collecting expeditions. And the other was writing to botanists and politicians and scientists and lay people in every city he could think of, asking for seeds and cuttings and dried specimens to collect at his garden. And those he got from all over the world, from some of the most eminent botanists, scientists of his day.
There were people traveling all over, and he wasn't an unusual person to ask for plant cuttings. In fact, it was a little bit of a competition when there'd be an exploration that went out, and he would be writing letters, begging and hoping and wheedling, and sometimes sticking his foot in his mouth, trying to get copies of these.
Yes, he wrote to President Thomas Jefferson, whom he had never met, and this is one of my favorite documents that I came across in the research, because it kind of captures Husick, how headstrong he is and how much he wanted to help his young nation. And sometimes those things came together to make him blunder forward a little bit. So he wrote to Jefferson and asked for specimens from the Lewis and Clark expedition when it returned. And he told Jefferson that he had founded a botanical garden. He sent him a list of a catalog of plants that he was growing there and said, when Lewis and Clark get back, I would really love some of the plants they found from across the North American continent, because Husick thought maybe there are plants out there that we don't know about that have medicinal purposes. And Jefferson, Husick didn't know this, but Jefferson was just then agonizing over whether the expedition had been lost. Husick, they got back several weeks later, and all was joyful, and they did discover many new plants, new to the scientists of the United States, certainly not new to the native peoples. But Husick went on and told Jefferson that he should think about founding a national network of federally funded botanical gardens, and he went on and on. But he really was very dogged in his effort to get plants and from everyone he could. And at that point, Jefferson did pretty much blow Husick off. But years later, after he realized what an accomplished scientist Husick was and how much he was doing for the young nation, Jefferson did start sending him seeds and plants from Monticello and letters of really gushing praise for his work.
He was a taskmaster. He would require people to report to this is the students. So this is kind of what he did. Hussack was required to report. They were required to report to his office at 9 o'clock each morning, and there they remained for the next 12 hours. These are his medical students, unless he released them to attend medical lectures at the college or took them on rounds at the hospital. Idle chatter among the young men attending his medical practice bothered Hussack, and he explicitly forbade conversation to be held on any topic other than medical subjects. He was such an exacting instructor, exacting employer. How did he get everything done that he wanted to get done? Were his days just as focused as he tried to get his medical students to be?
Yes. He took his cues from Benjamin Rush, who was one of his teachers, the great physician, Philadelphia physician. And Rush was an incredibly hard worker and also a teetotaler. And Hussack followed in his footsteps in that regard. He told his students that they shouldn't drink. It was incompatible with the dignity of a physician. And of course, if you were at home and you had a couple of drinks with dinner and after, and somebody came to your door seeking medical assistance, you weren't prepared to help them safely. And so he was very strict about that. And he also told his students, if they were late to his classes or to his office, he was incredibly severe with them, not because he was a mean person. His students really loved him. They were a little scared of him, but they also loved him. But he's told them that a tardy physician can kill a patient. So he was really trying to inculcate a sense of discipline for the benefit of the students and their patients. And yes, I think he was an unusually driven man. He was extraordinarily energetic. In addition to working on the garden and going up to Albany constantly trying to get funds out of the state government, he was teaching at Columbia. He was running his medical practice and teaching students there as well. He volunteered at several of the hospitals in the almshouse and at the state prison. And he founded or co-founded over his lifetime around a dozen institutions in all. So he published a massive amount on medicine and botany. So he's really an extraordinary figure. I was exhausted just studying him.
And there was a rivalry also between the United States and Europe, and like Jefferson and many Americans wanted to prove that America was going to be as great as Europe someday. And it just wasn't quite yet. It didn't have the great cities and universities. And the mammoth, even Jefferson was thrilled that it was found because it showed that America had a robust animal background. I don't know what I'm trying to say. A robust scientific background once mammoths ruled here. What did Europe think of the United States right now in New York and Philadelphia and the accomplishments of Peel and Hussack?
In the early years of the 1800s, when Hussack and Peel were especially active in this regard, along with many other men of science in the United States, there was a disdain on the part of Europe that they felt keenly. Hussack, when he was in London, he was very warmly received by some eminent scientists, especially Sir Joseph Banks, who was perhaps the most famous British scientist of his day, and also by James Edward Smith, Banks' protege, who founded the Linnaean Society. Hussack wrote to Benjamin Rush on his way home from Europe, from Great Britain, and said, you know, I've been very surprised by how warm a reception I've gotten from the British. They've been very kind to me, even though I'm a member of, you know, this country they were at war with. And he said, but they are waiting. Europe is waiting for the American experiment to fail. There was a sense on the part of, it varied depending on what scientist you were talking to in Europe. But there was a sense among some scientists that that the United States, that North America, that everything was puny and kind of savage. And, you know, the reason it was so important that the mammoth was giant was that it proved that Americans weren't puny and weak and sickly, that great creatures had roamed North America. And it was important to prove, to try to assemble data points that would show European scientists that North America was robust both physically and intellectually. And DeWitt Clinton complained about this in a speech that was Hussack's best friend and a multiple-time mayor and governor in New York. And DeWitt Clinton complained that, you know, in the second decade of the 19th century, that the British still, that every time Americans tried to show initiative in arts and letters and science, that the Europeans would sneer at them for their efforts, while also, if they didn't try, they were sneered at for not trying. So they really had an inferiority complex.
When did you first come across David Hussack, and what was it about him that drew you to him? The details in here show that you must have been looking over letters and receipts for years, the way you pieced it all together and made this beautiful story. But I was just, every once in a while, I'd pull up from the book and think, how did she get that detail? And how long has she spent with David Hussack anyway? What was it like? What drew you to him, and how long has it been?
I first discovered his story, his name even. I didn't know about him. It was about 10 years ago. I'm an organizational sociologist by training, which means I study organizations, and I am particularly interested in nonprofits and the history of nonprofits, both in Europe and the United States. And I was doing an academic paper on contemporary botanical gardens. For that study, I was reading in the history of American botanical gardens, and I read a couple pages about a guy who had founded a garden in 1801 on what is now the heart of Manhattan Island. It's definitely not garden territory anymore. And I was just enchanted by this story of a pastoral landscape and the pioneering institution disappearing in both physically and in our national memory. And I was kind of struck by lightning. It was one of those love at first sight moments. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of historians and other kinds of writers have those moments where everything falls away, and that becomes what you cannot stop thinking about, reading about, trying to find every scrap of paper about. And that his story took me over. I mean, really, sometimes I felt just pulled forward by the drive to tell this story, to recapture it. And because he was not famous, he was very famous during his lifetime, incredibly famous, and now we haven't heard of him. There were no papers published, you know, no critical edition of his letters. So I did go to archives all over the United States and several in Europe, collecting every receipt, every scrap. I went and found his father's receipts for, you know, when David Hussack was studying in London, his father's receipt book in the United States had, you know, sent David more money to buy botany books. And so everything I could find, because I wanted to recapture the daily life and excitement and sometimes devastation of this story.
So his botanical garden didn't survive, but New York City became a leading city. It didn't necessarily look like it would be. Maybe it could have been Philadelphia that became the biggest city in America. It could have been something else. It could have been, you know, what is it about New York City, do you think, that has made it into a world leading city?
I think that David Hussack and his peers began that process. I'm certainly wouldn't give David Hussack full credit for that in any way. Mm-hmm. He was one of a number of people working to establish the institutions that would put New York on the map. It, in a way, it's, you know, we think of New York's ancient history sort of back to the Gilded Age institutions. When I say to people, the first Museum of Fine Arts in New York was co-founded by David Hossack, they say, oh, the Metropolitan Museum? Or I say the first Museum of Natural History was co-founded by David Hossack, American Museum of Natural History? No, those were Gilded Age institutions. And those are the institutions that we often think of, whether as tourists or citizens, of as the what has really put New York on the map. But those institutions were the legacy of several earlier generations of New Yorkers, of writers and artists and institution builders like Hossack, who were establishing the precursor institutions. Now, those precursor institutions are almost all gone except for the New York Historical Society, which David Hossack was a co-founder of and one of the presidents of. Most of them that were in existence during his lifetime with his help are no longer there. But what we forget often is that the training that went on in those institutions, both organizationally, how do you organize citizens to create civic institutions, that kind of civic training went on through the creation of those institutions, and also the substantive training, whether it was in art history or curation or botany or medicine natural history, all of that training was going on. And we don't celebrate teachers the same way we celebrate, you know, someone who found a cure for a major illness. But the people who are doing that training quietly on a daily basis through those generations, they put New York on this footing that allowed those great institutions that we still have. The New York Botanical Garden is one of them that was founded in the 1890s. Those wouldn't have been founded without that legacy of institution building partnered with the Gilded Age fortunes that made them possible on that scale. So it does go back to Hossack's generation and the early American Republic, but there's a lot else that emerged in the 19th century to help put New York on the map. And of course, as a commercial metropolis, it was soon unrivaled in the nation.
There's a point in the book where it's 1809 and Hossack's at a celebration for the 200th anniversary of Henry Hudson's arrival. And I was just thinking that we're about 200 years away from Hossack, and it doesn't feel that long ago in some ways. How, does it feel like a long time ago to you or not, that after reading this book, suddenly it felt really close? Strangely.
I'm so happy to hear that. What I really tried to shove readers into those streets and into that garden and walk them along tree-lined streets that weren't even paved yet. And I tried to create that feeling of immediacy by bringing in a lot of the visuals of what Manhattan would have felt like then. And I also wanted to show how modern that some of the struggles and dreams of people like Hossack, how modern they were and still are. The concern, interest in nature, the reverence for the beauty and complexity of nature, the how hard it is to found civic institutions and fund them and keep them alive. That we're all still trying to do that today, and Hossack was also constantly trying to figure out ways to alleviate the physical and mental suffering of his fellow citizens. So those are all very immediate concerns for us today. And the more I learned about Hossack, the more I realized he's a very familiar figure in those ways. And when I'm on book tour right now, and I'm so enjoying meeting all of these David Hussacks across the country. And of course, now there are many women in Hossack circle who are very active in founding civic institutions. I didn't get to talk about them as much as I would have liked to, but they were very active. And now, of course, when I go across the country speaking to botanical gardens and museums and historical societies, the room is filled with men and women who are doing that same kind of work and living those same kind of struggles and helping put their cities on a humane and stable footing every day.
For the full story of David Hossack and the early history of medicine and botany in America, sure to check out Victoria Johnson's book, American Eden. It is a fantastic read. I just loved it. Okay, did you miss Carrie Miller's conversation with Anjali Kumar this week? It was such a great conversation. This is part of Carrie's Women of Faith series, which is also a podcast. So if you search wherever you get your podcasts, Women of Faith, you'll find it. So Anjali technically qualifies as a nun. This is someone who doesn't identify with any faith, but she told Carrie that doesn't mean she's not spiritual. And she detailed her journey to seek out God, including visits to shamans in Peru, practicing transcendental meditation in India, meeting with witches in New York, faith healer in Brazil. She even went to Burning Man to try to find faith. She found what she found when she went on this quest was different than what she set out to seek. You have to hear the conversation on Anjali Kumar talking to Carrie Miller for the NPR Women of Faith series. It's also a podcast. Find it. Listen.
Just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at Carrie NPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.